Thanks tuned to yesterday, bringing you programs from radio's golden era. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, true history from three programs. Later on, we'll hear the story of the invention of the cash register on Adventures in Research, also Strange as It Seems, a series from the 30s, a la Ripley's Believe It or Not. But right now, it's the police ride-along show, Night Watch, True Crime and Punishment, in the CBS broadcast next from February 3rd, 1955.
You're with four detectives moving in on the home of a suspect wanted for armed robbery. Two to the rear. We'll go to the front. Oddly enough, both of those officers had their partners killed on deals like this. The suspect is listed as about 16, 18 years. But the victim was hurt in that last holdup. That's not kid's play. We're not taking any chances. Shades up. Recognize the suspect from a mugshot. Sitting in a chair with his back to the door.
Open, Kurt. Let's take him. Police officer, stand up.
Hi, where are you?
What back.
Never mind. Put your hands up. Want to shake him, Kurt?
This is Don Reed, a police recorder.
Put your hands up.
You're on an armed robbery investigation with Detective Unit 5-6 on the night watch. Crew, Sergeant Ron Perkins. Partner, Sergeant Kurt Walter. Robbery detail. I'll record this as it happens. But where we go from here, your guess is as good as mine. But remember, the people you meet are not actors. This is it. This is real. This is Night Watch.
Aren't you curious why we're picking you up?
No.
I want to get a coat for him, Walter. He may not be back for a while.
All right, let's go.
Night Watch. The actual on-the-scene report of your police force in action. Every voice, every sound is authentic. Wherever Detective Unit 5-6 is called, you follow as the official police recorder transcribes the investigation. Night Watch, presented with the cooperation of the Police Department of Culver City, California, W.N. Hildebrand, Chief. We transfer you now to Detective Unit 5-6, operating somewhere in the field, and to police recorder Don Reed.
Well, at the moment, we're bouncing down an alley. We're going to flip around the block because we just spotted two juveniles coming out from behind a building on the boulevard. Both of them with their arms loaded down with something or other. Actually, we're en route to the station with a robbery suspect in custody in the back seat, but we couldn't pass up this situation that sort of aroused our suspicions. Now we're going around the corner. Or the hard way. Now we're okay. And, there's our two young suspects. Young fellows there, stepping out of the shadows, both with their arms full.
Police officers. Guard, you want to check them out? I'll have a look around the back of the building.
Sergeant Walter staying in the current, guarding our robbery suspect. Well, let's have a look at these two young fellows. Wide-eyed, just staring. Officers checking packages.
Careful. Trying to do our first good deed and we get hauled in. Get caught.
First good deed?
Well, we're trying to build up our name of our club. That's all we're trying to do.
What were you collecting all of it for?
You know, needy families. We got to build up our name and sitting around in our club meeting tonight, we couldn't figure nothing out, you know, so we decided we were going to start helping somebody out.
How long did it take you to collect that?
About an hour and a half, 2 hours. About 3 hours because we didn't start till about 9 o'clock.
How did you collect it?
Went up to knock on the door. So everybody had a porch light on or light on.
Mm-hmm. How are you going to determine what families are needy enough?
School. We'll hand them in to them in the morning. You know, if we can't take them, we'll deliver them.
What class are you boys in? All in the same class over there?
Polytech.
Did you find the people cooperative for the most part?
Yeah, we found a few people. We kind of felt like giving a little speech, but then we decided we better not. We're doing all this for, you know.
What sort of a speech? How'd you approach him? What'd you think?
Good evening, ma'am. Wait a minute. Give your speech first.
We're collecting food for needy families, for packages for school. We wonder if you had any candles.
Yeah, if you can, go make it look, you know, business-like and everything.
And then you'd say something after that, is all right?
No, he'd go him, and then I'd go him. See, and then I'd make my speech, and then he'd carry the food. And then whoever's carrying no good, no, don't have to
you,
do no
You would make the speech and he would carry all the food.
Yeah, or I carry it and he makes
that
the speech.
That way, too? Sounds like a good deal for him.
The guy who can talk, the one who gets out of all the work, huh?
We got donuts, we got everything. We got candy, they
what
did.
What teacher would have told you this Saturday morning? They knew there was some school that says, here, come leave the beavers, but have something to hold on
there. George, they check out okay. Building's all right.
Okay, boys.
Hey, fellas.
Right on home.
Nice going.
Family to get all that food now.
We decided we were going to take a trip, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get very far.
That takes care of that. Next stop is police headquarters with our young burglary suspect. You're in the detective bureau. Sitting in the chair, a robbery suspect we picked up a short while ago. Briefly, this is the layout. Last night, three young men held up a liquor store, slugged the owner over the head with a bottle of whiskey, escaped. A partial license number of the getaway car, a couple of good witnesses, and a lot of legwork, and we came up with a mugshot of one of the suspects.
Just after you left.
Identified. That's him sitting in front of us.
Completely knocked out.
Sergeants Walter Perkins questioning.
Ran to the door and saw you drive away.
Suspects unconcerned. Slouched in the chair.
Several suspicious cars.
Cigarette.
Out in front of the place.
Blowing smoke rings.
To him at the time.
I don't know anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can stick to that story if you like. But can't you just see the expression on a judge or a jury's face when two people, one witness and the other one the victim in this deal, the fall was hit over the head with a whiskey bottle? Can't you see those two people getting up on a witness stand and saying, that's the boy that was in my store? That's the boy that stuck me up. What would, if you were the judge or the jury, what would you say in a case like that?
I don't know.
So I know what they tell you when you get in these local jails, in the county jail, maybe even in the forestry camps. They tell you the police don't know anything. Don't tell them nothing. Because until you start talking, they're helpless.
No, I know that.
You'd be surprised how many people in San Quentin that still keep telling themselves that they're still in San Quentin.
Yeah, I know that they're a lot smarter than I am. Because I got caught for that, for everything I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about this deal? Let's get it squared away. Get it over.
I don't know nothing about this.
We make it a practice to watch fellows when we arrest them. And we consider that in court as admissions or confessions, just the very first statement they make whenever we tell them that they're under arrest. I know you'll remember it today when we told you that we want to bring you to Culver City for questioning. An innocent man would have said, where do you want to take me? We explained Culver City. Culver City, I've never even been there. What do you want to take me to Culver City for? I said, for questioning. You just said, for questioning about what? And you'd have just insisted on knowing what we were bringing you to Culver City for if you were completely innocent. But you didn't say anything. You didn't say a word.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to tell you I did something if I didn't do it, and then maybe I'll get off a little easier.
Oh, no, we wouldn't want that. We have never, and I don't think any good police officer would do that. I don't think they'd try to talk a person into admitting something and giving the big pitch about it getting it off easier. Because in the first place, we're not authorized to do that. I can't guarantee you anything about what will happen to you when you get in court. All I can say is that if you make a full statement in regard to the matter, that's just the way I'll put it down in the report. We could probably talk to you all night. We could probably beat you with a rubber hose if that was the method police use. We could probably throw you in a dark room. We could probably set you in a slanted chair. We could turn bright lights in your face. We could keep grilling you and grilling you. But we have no intention of doing that. We're gonna try to get you to see the light yourself. And if you can't see it, and we'll just take it to court and just let justice take its course.
I don't know anything about that. Just what I told you, it's what I'm going to keep telling.
You're going to stick to that story?
Yeah.
Okay, kiddo. It's your story, and you're stuck with it.
Okay, Kurt. Looks like we'll have to do this the hard way. We'll go out and bring in some witnesses and see if he still tells us the same story.
Okay. You'll be back in a second. And we'll do it the hard way. All right, right on. I brought the lock out and put it in the box.
Sitting in Detective Unit 5-6. Sergeants Perkins, Walter, picking up one of the witnesses of the robbery. Attempt to make another identification of the suspect.
You want to wait in here? This is Don Reed, our police recorder.
Hi.
I'll be back in a few minutes.
What happened on this deal last night?
Well, I walked in the liquor store about 4 minutes to two. And, went back to the icebox and got myself some beer, and there was another customer in the store at the time. And I walked up there. I was waiting for the fellow to wait on me. But he was having trouble with the cash register, waiting on another customer. He was punching keys all over the place. And he said, well, the boss is out. He went out in delivery, and I'm his new delivery boy. He showed me how to operate the cash register, but I don't know how. The other fellow and I both wanted to get our beer and get out of there before 2 o'clock. And, so he says, do you know how to operate the cash register? Well, I'd worked for this other liquor store, and so I knew how to operate it. Mm-hmm. So I said, surely, I'll clear it for you. So I went back there and cleared the cash register for him. And he had some keys stuck.
In the meantime, he was picking up the store.
Yeah, and I didn't know it. He got my head blown off. So I showed him how to clear the cash register, and he made an overring on it, which the detective will tell you was 211.
211.
Yeah.
Which is
so
penal code for armed robbery.
Yeah, I cleared it, and I showed him how to make out the overring. I just explained to him how you made the overring. He said, all right. And so I just took my beer and went out.
And you didn't know the place was getting stuck up?
No, heck no, I didn't.
You live dangerously.
I do.
Hey, that again. I'm lucky I didn't get shot, actually.
Yeah. No kidding.
We'd like for you to pick out the suspect that you saw in the bar. And if you're positive that he is the man, just say in a loud voice, that's the man that waited on me in the liquor store. That's the man that was behind the cash register, got the keys stuck, and I went around and helped him. And don't say anything else. Now, if you're not positive, it's the man. Then don't say anything, and just walk. Just walk away.
Get back to the station. See what happens.
Wake up, will you?
We're in the first floor cell block, arranging a lineup, taking a group of prisoners out to the show-up room, line them up in a row, mix the suspect in with them, see if the witness can pick him out.
I just want to be a member of a show-up.
Three prisoners out now. Here's the fourth.
You don't have to get me. I'm going to bring you right back.
Suspect being brought in. Four casual prisoners from the juvenile section. Two in shirt sleeves. Two with coats on. Our suspect, the only one with a jacket. Placing him on the right.
Walk right over alongside him.
Witness is coming in. Standing behind plate glass window. He can see the lineup. But they can't see him.
Take one of those men there and see if you can recognize him.
Witness. Pointing to the one on the right.
Would you like for me to ask him anything? Do you want him to make any statements? Turn around or anything like that? How about making the statement that the boss is out, I'm the delivery boy, I'm taking over for a little while. Make that statement.
The boss is out.
Make the statement. He showed me how to operate this cash register, but I got it stuck.
He showed me how to operate this cash register.
Put your hand straight down to the side and make a left turn. Turn around to your left, slowly, all the way around. All the way around. Okay, around again. Okay. Closer? One on the other. The one on the right.
the one in the jacket. Okay. Okay, you can go back to the shelter.
Bill, you want to put these other prisoners back? We want to talk to this boy again.
Escorting the young suspect into a small interrogation room.
Well, fellow, there's a second witness to identify you. You want to tell us about it now?
Suspect still continues to shake his head. Smile.
That gun you took, too, was hotter than a firecracker. If you didn't throw that gun away, I bet you'd get picked up with that. Do you know if your buddy's got the gun?
I don't know.
Well, you know if you have it.
I don't have any gun. Never did.
But who had this gun in the robbery?
You guys ain't gonna bluff me into telling that by little things like that. Where's it going?
We're not trying to bluff you into telling. We already told you what we got. We don't want to bluff you. We don't want to bluff you into nothing.
Well, if you got it, I mean, just put me back in my cell. But I'm not telling you anything. I don't know nothing about it.
All right, Kurt. Let's abide by his request. Want to put him back, Bob?
Young fellow, glancing back. Same smile.
We got plenty of time, fellas. This is what we get paid for. We'll be back. Here's my gun, Jim.
Here's the other one. Going into the cell block. Leaving all the weapons behind.
Right now,
In the juvenile section of the jail. It took us better than an hour to locate our next witness. We found him in a neighborhood theater. This gentleman got a good look at the three suspects that robbed the liquor store. In fact, the suspect carrying the box of money and the gun ran right into him. Now, it's our belief that this is the same suspect that we're holding here in the cell. Sergeant Perkins instructing the witness, breathing hard, elderly, very nervous.
What I want you to do, there are five cells in here, each one holding a prisoner. I want you to just walk past the cells normally and look into each cell. And as you see the person, if you can recognize him, why, just don't say anything to him. Just turn around and walk right back. That's all you have to do. Just take it easy, okay?
Okay.
Suspect is located in number three cell. Witness walking slowly. Checking the first one. Taking a good look. No soap. Moving on to number two cell. Staring through the bars. Glancing back. Shaking his head. Moving on to number three. Witness stop. Straightening up. Turning on his heel. Trace of excitement on his face, eyes darting from officer to officer.
Well?
That's the boy, I'm positive.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We appreciate your cooperation. I'll have a radio car take you home. Bob, will you show him out, please? Kurt? Let's see if our boy still has the same opinion.
Young suspect still on bunk. Extreme end of cell.
You probably recognize that gentleman. He certainly recognized you. That's three now that place you right smack at the scene.
All right. I'll tell you the whole deal.
That's more like it.
Jim, will you let us in three? Okay, let's go on upstairs and talk about it. Come on.
How old are you?
I'm 16.
You know that we have identified you and made you on this robbery at this liquor store. Now, will you tell me in your own words exactly how it happened
Well, I don't exactly know exactly what right time it was when we left Englewood. And said that he had a place picked out perfectly for it, you know. So he drove around, looking at all of them, and he saw this one in Culver City here. It was about just before closing time, I don't know what time.
About 1:30
around there. And kept the car running, and we walked in, and the guy looked at us so funny, and I got so scared, and I kept nudging to going outside, you know, come on, let's leave, I don't like it, you know. And he sort of nudged back to go in the room, so I pulled the gun out, told him to go in the back room. He went in the back room, and I went out and got the money on the cash register. And he went in the back room, and I heard a crash, and I didn't know what it was, and I just took off with the money out the front door, and I had laid the little gun under the counter when a customer came in. When I heard the crash, I forgot to get it, and just ran outside, and they came out, and all I got a, I don't know what caliber it was an automatic pistol. It was under the counter. They told me to get it if I saw a gun.
And you got this gun, and when you took the money out of the cash register, son, do you know approximately how much money it was? Was it all in currency, or was it in silver and currency?
Well, silver and currency.
I see.
Put it in a cigar box, but I could hold all the silver money, that much of it in my hand. I wouldn't say there would be $75 worth.
Of silver or...
Or all together.
All together.
And all the money.
Well, when you heard this crash in the back room where your two partners were, did they tell you that they had hit the man over the head with something?
When we got out in the car, yes.
What did he say?
I can't remember the exact words.
Well, approximately.
Well, approximately, I just said, what was all that commotion? And he said, well, just knocked him out or something like that.
Did he say it hit him with a whiskey bottle or something?
No, but when he said he knocked him out, I heard the crash. I just thought knew what it was then.
I see. This gun now that you used, what caliber gun was that?
The one I had?
Yeah.
It was a .22.
Whose gun was that?
That was my dad's.
Was the gun loaded?
At the time of the robbery?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
When you pointed the gun at the man, what did you say to him in the liquor store?
I says, this is Dick up getting the back room.
What did he say?
He didn't say nothing. I guess said, all right, and he walked in the back room.
Walked in the back room.
Mm-hmm.
And then what did you do after he walked in the back room? Did you stay in the back room with him?
No, I told him to lay down on the floor, just like you guys had told me to tell him what to do.
Yeah.
And I went over to cash register, and I couldn't get it open. He had to hit so many buttons in a certain one, you know. I didn't know how to get it open. So two customers walked in then, and I overrang a certain amount, and then he came behind the counter and wrote down something on a piece of paper about overrang $1 something like that, and then he opened it, showed me how to open it.
The customer did that?
Yes.
And then did the customer leave?
Yes.
He walked out?
I just sort of waved to him, and he drove off.
Mm-hmm. And then you ran out of the store?
Yes, I had the money and the gun in the box. And
did they ever tell you anything about other robberies that they had committed?
No, they didn't tell me anything like that. They never talked much about that, but I imagine they did because they knew how to do it.
Did you ever use any form of narcotics?
Well, try it, and but it gave me headaches, cough, and choke, and I didn't like it at all.
Comes pretty high.
Hmm?
Dope comes pretty high.
For 2 grams, $40.
When do you use it, Dave?
Maybe 3.
You're 16 years old, and you still got a long time in front of you.
I'm just glad I wasn't 18, that's all.
Yeah, at 18, you'd be on your way to San Quentin.
Just one last question. Did you pull these stick-ups to get money to buy narcotics?
Yeah.
Okay, here you go. Now.
What you have just heard is real. Recorded as it actually happened on The Night Watch. We switch you now back to headquarters and the desk of Police Chief W.N. Hildebrand.
Tonight you have followed one phase of a robbery investigation. As you may have noted, reference to the two other suspects and their descriptions were carefully censored from the broadcast. The reason was they were still at large at the time. The older of the trio was located in jail where he was being held on a narcotic charge. With the information supplied by the young suspect we heard tonight, the last of his accomplices was taken into custody. With the final arrest, 24 armed robberies were cleared throughout Southern California. For a moment, let's determine how the detectives were able to break this case. A witness obtained a partial license number, another gave an accurate description, still another remembered a tattoo mark. Without the assistance of the citizens involved, this young trio of bandits would possibly be committing still another robbery tonight, maybe even more victims injured. This is what your local law enforcement agency means when they say no department can be effective without the cooperation of the citizens. If tonight we have emphasized this point sufficiently, then we have a reason for night watch.
Thank you, Chief Hildebrand. You have been following Detective Unit 5-6 on its tour of duty on the Night Watch. Every voice, every sound has been real.
Night Watch, on Tuned to Yesterday from February 3rd, 1955 on CBS, at that time part of the network's Thursday night lineup at 8:30. The producer-director Sterling Tracy actually worked on other series on CBS like The Whistler, Jeff Regan, Investigator, and the forerunner to this series, which exists only in an audition called Police Recorder. About a year before that pilot was produced, Sterling Tracy was the chief editor for another audition for radio featuring Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, the radio version that never came to pass of the show I Love Lucy. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now on to the program Adventures in Research. Speaking of crime, this is about the invention of the cash register, released for syndication on November 23, 1954.
Adventures in Research. You've probably noticed that things sound different to us when we have our eyes closed. What sounds like a forest fire might be only the crackling of cellophane. Or what sounds like an avalanche might be only kettle drums. But there's no mistaking this sound. That's right, the cash register. And this is the story behind this remarkable invention. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science produced as a public service in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. And today, telling you the story of the cash register. Our story begins in Dayton, Ohio, in 1878, where we might have strolled into a little cafe.
Hey there, Jake.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, fine, Fred, fine. Can't complain. Well, not too much, anyway.
Well, I should hope not. You're doing right good business here, Jake. Coffee's good, too. Hot.
Nice of you to stop in, Fred.
Well, as soon as I heard you opened the place, I said, well, least I can do is stop by, pay my respects to my friend Jake Ritty. Said to myself, Jake Ritty's got himself a cafe. I'll just stop in and see.
Mighty nice of you, Fred. Now, if you'll excuse me,
Right nice place you got here. Doing a good business, too. Regular little gold mine, I'd say. Reckon you'll be making a mint here. Business keeps up the way it started.
Well, thank you, Fred. But really, if you'll excuse me now, I'd better get back to the counter.
Now, hold your horses, Jake. You got plenty of hired help. Don't forget, you're the owner. You don't have to work your head off.
You think so, do you, Fred? Well, you got a lot to learn. The boss has to work harder than anybody.
Oh.
Got to greet people and shake hands. See that we got clean dishes and that people get waited on and get what they want when they want.
Well, you got plenty of help. So you just sit here and rest your legs. Why, money must be pouring in.
Tell you the truth, Fred. I keep so doggone busy, I don't have much of a chance to keep my eye on the cash drawer. When I do look at it, it ain't as full as it should be.
Oh, now don't come talking poor mouth to me, Jake Ritty. I bet that cash box is bulging with greenbacks.
No, Fred, it isn't. Business is real good. Oh, I know I got the customers and all that. But still, I ain't making as much as I know I should be. It's got me worried. real worried.
Nonsense. You got nothing to worry about.
It's that cash drawer back there. I can't keep an eye on it all the time. Money's disappearing out of that cash drawer. It's got me worried, I tell you.
Oh, Jake, you're just working too hard. And tell you what, I got a ship leaving the end of the month. Now, why don't you take a vacation and come aboard? Be a nice cruise. Give you a chance to calm yourself down.
Really? Well, now, that isn't a bad idea, Fred.
Of course not.
Doc Archer told me I ought to take a rest. And a pleasure cruise sounds like fun.
Sure. Why don't you come along? You can get somebody here to tend to the place and look out for your business.
Oh, I'm afraid I got too many people looking out for my business already, Fred. And not enough looking out for Jake Ritty.
So with a doleful glance at the cash drawer back of the counter, James Ritty left his Dayton cafe and at the end of the month found himself on an ocean cruise.
Fred, this is the life.
Didn't I tell you you'd find it pleasant?
Yeah, I sure do. I feel like my restaurant is a million miles away. You know something? I've completely forgotten about receipts and cash on hand and cash drawers and expenses and overhead.
Now, what did I tell you?
Just sitting here on deck watching the waves and the gulls. Wonderful. Don't even have to turn a hand.
Well, now, I tell you, Jake, this is a mighty nice craft. I'd like to show you around a bit. Hey, come on down to the engine room and have a look. You never saw such an engine in all your born days.
Be glad to, Fred. Providing I don't have to stoke any coal.
Oh, none of that. Shucks, nowadays everything works by machines, so a man don't have to do much anything. Hey, right through this door, Jake. There you be. Ain't that a beauty?
It sure is. What's that big round dial for over there, Fred?
Oh, that clock's the revolution of the ship's propeller shaft. Yeah, see?
By itself?
Yep, all automatic. Shows you how many revolutions the shaft is making. From that, you know you're nuts.
By jingo, that is something. You know, Fred, if they can clock and record the movements of a ship's propeller like that, why can't somebody build a device to record sails? Now, that'd cure the raiding of my cash drawer.
Now, Jake, you said you wasn't going to do a whit of thinking on this cruise, and by golly, there you go.
Now, don't bother me, Fred. I am thinking. And if what I'm thinking can be done, Fred, how long will it take you to get me back to shore?
From that instant on, one idea obsessed James Ritty. A machine that would register and record sails. He interested his brother John. Together, they designed and redesigned, built and rebuilt, and finally came up with the first model, which was installed back of the counter in James Ritty's Dayton Cafe.
Clear that space off, Barney. Let me put this down.
Land of Goshen, Mr. Ritty. What's that?
That, Barney, is a cash register, and I'm going to show you how to work it. From now on, my books are going to start balancing.
Gosh, how does it work, Mr. Ritty? Looks awful complicated to me.
Oh, no, nothing complicated about it. Simple as ABC. Now, you see these two rows of keys across here?
Yeah.
Well, they got figures on them. Now, when you make a sail, you push down the number that represents the size of the sail, like this. Now, those hands up there, you see them go around this dial?
Yeah, like a clock.
No, it isn't a clock. It's a dial. And it shows you how much money you rung up. One hand registers dollars and the other cents. You ring up the sail and then put the money over here in the cash drawer. Like that 25 cents I just rung up. See?
Land of Goshen. That's right. Fancy. Only one thing, Mr. Ritty, I'm thinking.
Yeah?
Why don't you really put a clock up there? Then we'd know what time it was and wouldn't have to go out to the kitchen to look at the time.
It isn't a clock. It's a cash register. And from now on, Barney, you're going to use it.
Yes, sir, Mr. Ritty.
Oh, Barney, stop! What in tarnation are you doing?
Well, I was just trying it out, Mr. Ritty.
But you can't do that until some money comes in. Otherwise, we'll be as far off in our receipts as ever.
Gosh. I'm sorry, Mr. Reddy.
How much did you ring up, Barney?
I hit this key here. It says $5.
$5. So far, I haven't even used my machine. And already, it set me back $5.
James Ritty's first cash register needed improvement, and he made them in his next efforts. He mounted a wide paper roll inside his second machine. Then, when the keys were depressed, holes were punched in the roll of the paper. And then, at the end of each day, Ritty would check the roll. If there were 10 holes in the 5-cent column, he could see that he had done a 50-cent business in nickel sales. By counting each column, he could arrive at the grand total of sales for the day. Then, other improvements were added, including a new kind of indicator that showed the customer the sale price by means of pop-up numbers. But there was one more improvement still to be made.
Mr. Ritty, about this machine of yours, I've been thinking.
I just as soon you wouldn't, Barney. The last time you did that, it cost me $5. Then the other day, when you hit the wrong key, it took me an hour to unscramble things.
Well, Mr. Reddy, I just wanted to say, you know, if we could move this machine of yours over there, closer to the cash drawer, we wouldn't have to be doing so much walking. Being on my feet all day ain't doing them any good at all, Mr. Reddy, and I was thinking that maybe...
Now, wait a minute, man. Maybe you do have something, Barney.
I sure do. Bunions. I got a bunion here as big as...
I'm not interested in your bunions. You know, we could build the cash drawer right in the machine itself. I don't see why not.
Why, sure. That way, whoever wanted to use the cash drawer could just help themselves. Just in a manner of speaking, I mean.
So they could. Maybe I could put a bell on it, Barney, huh?
A bell?
Uh-huh. Then every time the cash drawer opens, the bell would ring. That way, anybody who wanted to get into the cash drawer would have to ring up a sale. Yeah, you know, I think it's a good idea, Barney. A real good idea.
Whether James Ritty actually thought of incorporating the cash drawer and bell into his machine isn't clear. At least he never got around to doing it. Never produced that now familiar sound. No, because James Ritty couldn't interest anyone in buying his machines. Merchants, to whom he tried to sell them, said,
Nothing but a newfangled expensive fad.
And the clerk said,
Hey, get one of them thief catchers in this store and I quit.
So Ritty sold his entire cash register business for $1,000. And it was sold and resold until it ended up as the property of a financier named Phillips, George Phillips. And the cash register was called...
Phillips Folly.
But, Mr. Phillips, sir...
Phillips Folly, that's what it is. You know it and I know it. The stock of this company isn't worth the paper it's printed on. Every merchant in town laughs at that fool register. Yeah, but here's the point. I've got a customer coming in. He's interested in it.
In Phillips Folly?
Hang it, don't say that. Above all, don't say that when he gets here. This fellow Patterson thinks he might be able to market the thing.
Has he offered a price?
$6,500.
$6,500 for that?
Now, don't you dare say anything to mess up the deal. Don't raise an eyebrow even. Not one snicker, you hear?
Yes, sir. You can trust me. I won't even mention Phillips Folly. The cash register.
John H. Patterson bought the rights to the cash register. Angered by the jeers and jokes about his purchase, Patterson resolved to make a success of it. He opened what was probably the first modern business training school. He sent his salesmen to school, rehearsed them in their sales talk, and started the National Cash Register Company on its successful way. In 1905, he abolished the hand crank and converted the cash register to electricity. He made sales all over the world and designed registers to record everything from dollars and cents to kopecks and cruzeiros. And as the cash register grew in popularity, beauty, and versatility, it also grew in complexity.
Ritty's original machine had 546 parts. The modern cash register may boast some 17,000 and is almost a complete mechanical bookkeeper in itself. Today, this astonishing machine can even compute the amount of change due the customer after every sale. Yes, thanks to a pilfered cash drawer, a ship's propeller, and a $6,500 investment, the cash register is part of our daily lives. Product of another important adventure in research. And that's today's Adventures in Research, produced in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories.
Adventures in Research, on Tuned to Yesterday, that broadcast called No Sale, from November 23, 1954. And our last program in this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday is Strange as It Seems. Stories from around the globe almost too fantastic to believe. You be the judge next with this March 22, 1935 broadcast from CBS.
The makers of X-Lax present Strange as It Seems.
The author who ate his book.
We are now in the year 1644, and the following scene takes place in the great council hall of His Majesty King Christian IV of Denmark.
Carries his age well, but he's in a bad mood this morning.
There's trouble in store for someone.
Your Majesty.
Your Majesty.
Where is that prisoner?
The prisoner is here, Your Majesty.
Step forward. Are you Theodore Ranking?
Yes, Your Majesty.
Here is a book which I've been looking over. Are you the author?
I am, sire.
Are you aware that what you've written here amounts to treason?
I meant no disloyalty to my king or my country. I've written what I believe to be true.
It's a lie. It's intended to appeal to the emotions of my people, to stir up discontent, revolution.
Your Majesty.
And above all, when we're in the midst of a vicious invasion by the army of Sweden.
Your Majesty, hear me.
You preach democracy, the rule of the people. They're ignorant and unfit to govern themselves.
But the people can govern
you. You would put some adventurer on my throne.
Sire!
Silence! You have committed a crime against the people you pretend to champion. This book is an offense against reason and justice. It's an infamous lie. For this disloyalty, you shall die.
Blame me if you will, Your Majesty, but the voice of the people cannot be forever silent. Others will rise to speak where I have stood.
So, you would die a martyr for the cause of democracy, eh? Very well, then. I shall give you an alternative. Here is your book. Take it. Now, eat it, or tomorrow your head will fall under the axe of my executioner.
Eat the book or die. Eat it.
It is the following morning. King Christian again sits upon his throne as the pale but undaunted writer is led before him.
King, are you prepared to receive your sentence?
I am, Your Majesty.
Executioner, is the axe ready?
Exquisitely sharp, Your Gracious Majesty.
But I claim to receive amnesty, Your Majesty. Yesterday you granted me an alternative.
Huh? Oh. So I did. Do you mean to tell me you've managed to digest this fable about democracy?
It is easier to digest than Your Majesty assumes.
What? You ate the book?
I tore it into tiny pieces and ate it in my soup.
He ate it in his soup?
He tore it into tiny pieces in his soup.
Strange as it seems, Theodore Rankin did eat his book on democracy.
and Denmark has remained a monarchy. Incidentally, the king kept his word. The world's largest family. A patriarch is the father and ruler of a family or tribe. Abraham was a patriarch. Noah was, well, Noah's family was almost too large. But in spite of modern tendencies, all the patriarchs are not dead. For in a little Austrian town lives Herr Steinberg.
Oh, excuse me, is Steinberg at home?
I am Herr Steinberg.
Herr Steinberg, I am Kraus of the Orphan Welfare Society of Salzburg. I have come to ask for you a donation for the little orphan.
For the little ones?
Yeah, and the big ones, too.
You want that I should give you money for all those Salzburg children?
Oh, not all of them, Herr Salzburg.
Just the little ones and the big ones.
Surely you can afford a few crisis, Herr Steinberg. Perhaps you have children.
Perhaps I have children. Yeah, I got 87 children.
Oh, you have orphan asylum also.
Nein, they are my children, my sons and daughters.
You're joking.
It is no joke.
But it is impossible, Herr Steinberg.
You think that I cannot count my own children?
But 87?
I was married twice. The first Frau Steinberg had 4 sets of quadruplets, 7 sets of triplets, and 16 sets of twins. She had 69.
It is wonderful.
The second Frau Steinberg had 18 children.
That's a miracle.
87 children I have living.
Oh, what a blessing.
A blessing? Maybe that's a blessing. In my life, I have bought 1,282 pairs of shoes for my children. Today, I got to buy geese for Christmas. Geese und Marzipan for 300 people. Now, das ist doch genug, nicht wahr? Now, come see me after New Year's. Maybe I give you a goose for the orphan.
Oh, excuse me, Herr Steinberg. Merry Christmas, Herr Steinberg.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
Strange as it seems, according to an authentic report in the Vienna Medical Journal, Bernard Steinberg has been the father of 87 children. According to last report, he was enjoying excellent health, as well as considerable fame as a family man. The lamp that burned 70 years. You are now in a little village on the outskirts of Binghamton, New York. It is late at night, and a stranger gropes his way through the foggy darkness. The last resident of the town seems to have gone to bed. But wait. Yes, there is a light, faintly glimmering through the fog. The stranger quickens his steps. At last, here is someone who may be able to direct him.
Saw your light burning in the window. Can you tell me where Mr. Fellows lives?
What name did you say?
I'm looking for the home of Mr. R.H. Fellows.
Oh, I thought you said Fellows. Are you sure you don't mean Fellows?
No, madam. The name is Fellows.
Well, if you wish to come in.
Oh, thank you. I will for a minute. Oh, it's very cozy in here. But didn't I hear someone playing the melodeon?
I play it sometimes at night.
Well, I'm thankful someone keeps the light burning in this village after 10 o'clock.
My light is always burning. It has been burning in that window every night for 70 years.
70 years?
Yes.
May I take the liberty of asking for whom you've been waiting all these years?
For him. Did you say you knew someone named Fellows?
No, madam.
Oh, everyone has forgotten him, except me. John Fellows was a good man. If he still lives, he will come back to me.
You were to marry him.
Yes, but my father would not give his consent. He drove John Fellows from our house. Oh, listen. Did you hear someone at the gate?
No, it was only the wind rising. It will clear away the fog.
Oh, the lamp is the symbol of my undying love.
You cannot forget.
My memories are all I have. For 70 years, I have not left this house.
70 years.
He was my only love. But we shall meet again.
I hope so. The weather's clearing now, so I'll be on my way. Thank you for asking me in. Good night, madam.
Good night.
You have just heard Strange as It Seems by John Hicks, directed by Cyril Armbruster.
Strange as It Seems, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 22nd of March 1935 on CBS. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from the golden age of radio. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.